belief is sufficient to preserve the immortal spirit from the pits of hell. Considered from the philosophical point of view, virtues, being resident in the soul, must serve as the bridge across which human consciousness passes to be united with its spiritual cause. When we elevate the concerns of the body above those of the inner nature, we threaten the integrity of our soul life and thereby endanger our rationality. The second death of theology is the death of the soul, at which time the individual's astral light body is disintegrated back into the anima mundi, which is the soul of God. These, then, are the major elements in the occult constitution of man. 1. The spirit, which is the eternal foundation and the abiding reality, by virtue of which man is immortal, superior to both beginnings and ends, and eternal in his own heavenly nature. 2. The soul, which is the intermediary by which the life in each is mingled with the starry life in all, and the qualities of the sidereal bodies are communicated to each individual, who thus manifests through vices and virtues the states of excess and temperance existent in the sidereal nature. 3. The body which, being of the earth earthy, is the outer framework wherein the higher nature is imprisoned, as within a cage during the period of its exile in the materia universe. As the constitution of man is suspended from spiritual wholeness by three monads called unities, so in the secret religions of antiquity the orders of the priesthood were patterned from this holy mystery. The temple itself was the human body, and the priests who officiated at the various rites signified the spiritual agencies by which the mortal structure was sustained. In the sacerdotal orders of the pagan Roman Empire, for example, the abiding unity was represented by the Pontifex Maximus, the chief of the Pontifical College and supreme monad of the order of spiritual dispensation. This august person was served by three flamines, whose duties consisted of lending their sacred presence to the ceremonials of certain gods. Are not these flamines the breaths or flames that bear witness to the hidden and unknowable light dwelling thrice? A philosophic consideration, of Man 391. 392 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Concealed in their midst, the flamines of the first rank were designated the flamen dialis, the flamen martialis, and the flamen quirinalis, and were chosen from the patrician class to signify that they were of the race of heroes. Later the number of flamines was increased to 15 and their order divided into the flamen majors and the flamen minors, the first consisting of the holy three and the second of the lesser 12. The 12 lesser flamines are the monads or powers of the 12 holy animals which collectively form the physical ichal body of man and which are represented in the almanac by the signs of the zodiac distributed throughout the human body. The flamen majors in Freemasonry are the three grand masters of the Lodge of Jerusalem who are united together in the service of the hidden king, the Pontifex Maximum Universalis. The flamines miners have their anal ogi in the 12 fellow craftsmen who, venturing forth in parties of three, seek the body of their murdered master. Thus, man, the microcosm, becomes the pattern after which nil the procedures in the inferior universe are ordered and whose parts are combined in a profound and mystical arrangement. Among the gods of the Kabyrian rite were several diminutive figures with curiously distorted bodies, and bearing the marks of advanced age. These monstrosities provoked the ridicule of Cambyses, who could not conceive them objects worthy of veneration. In the mystery rituals, reference is repeatedly made to a strange dwarf equal in size to the human thumb who, dwelling alone in the sanctum sanctorum, is never visible to man but hides himself amid the furnishings of the sanctuary. According to Paracelsus, the rational knower dwells in the auric radiances of the heart, being a flame-like body equal in size to the last joint of a man's thumb. In the Kathopanishads of the Brahmans, it is also written that there is a man, the size of the thumb, who dwells in the ether of the heart and who is called the mystery flame. From these sources is thus established the nature of the Kabarayan dwarf, whose physical proportions were inconsiderable but who was yet greater than all the universe, for when Krishna in the Vamuna avatar assumed a diminutive stature, he was yet able to cross the earth in 3 strides. The mysteries held the rational part of man to be in consequential from the standpoint of physical measure, but in its superphysical magnitude great enough to include all existence within its scope. Thus was emphasized the spiritual reality that quality and not bulk is the true measure of size. The little man in the heart rules the great man in the world. For the body structure is like some huge machine whose complexity, while far eclipsing the insignificant proportions of its operator, is powerless without the conscious mind and guiding hand which controls all its parts and functions. Though the subject of reincarnation has been touched upon elsewhere in this work, it is nevertheless appropriate when considering the relationship of man as a spiritual entity to man as a physical personality, to discuss more at length the bonds which unite the superphysical consciousness to its physical ical environment. The spiritual agencies conspiring to produce the creature which we designate man are thus described by Plato: "Indeed, it is necessary to understand man, denominated according to species, as a being proceeding from the information of many senses, to a perception contracted into one reasoning power." G.R.S. Mead translates the latter part of Plato's statement to read, "and collected into a unit by means of R.A. Shiasanation." From this definition we are to infer that the objective man is founded in the reaction of the senses and that, after emerging from sensations, man attains stability by organizing these sensations with the aid of his rational nature. If these sense stimulations are not analyzed with respect to cause and mutual relationship, it is impossible for unity to exist within the nature, and for lack of such unity man must continue to exist as a bundle of contradictions held together only by instinct. It has already been stated that man does not actually enter into his immortality until he becomes conscious of that immortality. The instinctive man is consequently not immortal because in his consciousness there is still a vast preponderance of mortal elements. The eternal ebb and flow of cosmic processes contribute instability to the whole tempura. A philosophic consideration, of man, 393. 394 lectures on ancient philosophy. Meant, and in response to this inconstant action the soul abides in a state of untranquility. Spirit is the supreme power, and only when through initiation into the mysteries of the spiritual spheres he is moved to unite his soul and body with his spiritual part does man actually achieve immortality. Noble aspirations incline the soul toward the great king, and only by absorbing his inferior constitution into the substances of this first of immortals does man actually annihilate the interval between his temporal existence and his eternal endurance. The problem of metempsychosis was one that profoundly occupied the attention of Platonist, Neo-Platonist, and Gnostic alike. The Pythagorean doctrine of transmigration as expounded by Empedocles was admitted to contain an arcane rather than a literal meaning. While apparently accepting the doctrine of the literal transmigration of human souls into the bodies of animals, Plotinus undoubtedly possessed a knowledge of the esoteric interpretation of the doctrine, for nowhere else In his writings does he so freely employ irony and ridicule. Proclus, Chalcidius, and Hermes all maintained that it was unphilosophic to affirm that the human soul could ever return in the body of an animal, for the very will of the gods forever preserves so noble a creature as the soul from such a disgrace. Proclus enters the lists in Plato's defense, setting for himself the task of interpreting Plato's allusions to the return of man in a brutish constitution. Proclus reminds the reader that when in the Republic Plato declares that the soul of their sites assumed the life of an ape, the word life, and not body, was very explicitly used, thus signifying that the soul assumed the irrational appearance, though not necessarily taking on the physical form of an ape. Again, in the Phaedrus, Plato describes the descent of souls into a brutish life, but nowhere does he state that they assumed brutish bodies, for in Platonic philosophy life is not synonymous with form. By all this commentary, Proclus attempts to show that Plato referred solely to the invisible constitution, describing the various changes occurring therein when it is molded by the diversity of human moods. Through living a bestial life, man causes his inner nature to assume the appearance of a beast, and is known to the wise not according to the contour of his physical body, but according to the visage of his soul. When so completely possessed by animalistic traits that the soul takes on the similitude of a beast, he is classified according to the species of his soul and hence may reasonably be termed an animal. Pythagoras delved even more deeply into the occult conditions resulting from a depraved life, circulating among a selected group of disciples a conclusion still more profound concerning the condition of the unrighteous dead. He declared that as like attracts like, and man by common impulse verges toward natures most closely resembling his own, it was natural for the virtuous to incline toward God and for the vice-ridden to incline toward the beast. Pythagoras did not intend to liken a bad man to a good animal, but rather employed the animal as a symbol of a nature in which rationality is dormant and the impulsive nature supreme. He stated that under certain circumstances a depraved human soul might attach itself to an animal even as a daemon might attach itself to a man. The human soul did not actually enter into the constitution of the animal, but rather verged toward the instinctive nature of the animal in an effort to gratify its own uncurbed desires. Hence an animal may be moved or influenced by a human soul even as Socrates was influenced by his daemon. A certain animal exhibiting almost human intelligence may owe that quality to some human soul that has attached itself to the superphysical nature of that animal. In ancient theology, Hermes was called the psychopomp, the lord of souls and shepherd of men, of whom Proclus writes, "Hermes governs the different herds of souls, and disperses the sleep and oblivion with which they are oppressed. He is likewise the supplier of recollections, the end of which is a genuine intellectual apprehension of divine natures." Hermes is, consequently, the divinity presiding over metempsychosis, administering the laws which cause men to return to mortal existence periodically until the generating soul has liberated itself from the idea of form. The herds of souls